Accession number 30136, Reel 2.
The Fred Orr, Reel 2.
Well, first of all, you've got to understand what was happening in the interwar periods between World War I. It was predominantly occupied by Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs, who regarded this as their own country. And there was a small Jewish population, and they were cleverer, more industrious, and they tended to occupy the nicer parts, fertile parts of a not very fertile country. And what someone described as the creeping process of immigration, more and more Jews tended to come in during that period, and they got to the point after the war. After the war, of course, the Holocaust survivors thought that this was the kingdom of heaven as far as they were concerned, and they were striving to come into the country. And the Israeli people themselves were determined to be hard-nosed about it and say, this is our country, the Bible says so. And the Arabs, well, they're just second-class citizens. We're occupying it, it's our country, and that's that. And the British had the unenviable task, as usual, of standing in between and getting abused by both parties. Each party accuses of being favouring the other. British soldiers got shot in the back very often by Israeli terrorists. There are two terrorist gangs. One of them was headed by the chap Began, who later on became Prime Minister of Israel. And they had the nasty tactic of shooting British soldiers in the back, stealing their rifles. And gradually it got so unpleasant that the Prime Minister of the day, Clement Attlee, saw that the British soldiers were on a hiding to nothing and said, sorry, not our problem. Get that. At which point the Israelis, 1948, 47 and 48, gradually got total control of the country, established their own political regime there, and the Arabs were pushed over to the western side, very much like the ancient Britons were pushed by the Saxons into Wales and Brittany, and they were just left there as refugees. They did work for the Jews, but in a very subservient capacity. And although the neighbouring Arab states were very hostile to the Jews, they never really gave a helping hand to the Palestinians, and they haven't done so to this day. So the Palestinians have really felt rather betrayed and left on their own, whereas the Jews had the powerful backing and support of America. They had nothing.
You were there from April
July 1947, yes. After which time I was demobilised and became a civilian.
So what, you were doing guard duty and
patrols? Guard duty and doing patrols, yes. Along railway stretches and roads, you know, to make sure that no mines had been planted.
How did you go about that? What was the procedure?
Well, guard duty is just marching up and down outside your the barracks, but the patrols was just going along stretches of railway and road and just checking to see whether there's any ambuscades or any object, any mines or anything.
But with the mine detector, how did you go
about the mine? Oh, we didn't use the mine detective apparatus, not for that purpose. No, this weren't... They weren't like the Germans. The Germans used to sow mines like weeds, you know, and that was very tricky. No, we had to look out for the occasional ambuscade. I never actually encountered any one at all.
What exactly is an ambuscade?
An ambush. Ambush. Yes. They moved around a lot, you see, like terrorists do, you know, hitting here and then withdrawing, and they're not in any particular place, and the British soldiers tried to hunt them down with indifferent success. Politically, their hands were tied behind their back, very much as the British soldiers in Northern Ireland were. In fact, it was a Northern Ireland situation to a large extent. There were two contending factions hating each other, and the British soldiers as piggy in the middle. 2 1947 Palestine experiences are etched in my memory. The Israeli terrorists had the nasty tactic of shooting a British soldier in the back and then stealing his rifle. The colonel in charge of our particular unit was so incensed that he threatened the direst consequences for any soldier leaving his rifle unattended. Whereupon one of our overzealous NCOs, who'd been criticised for inefficiency and was thus anxious to impress, sneaked up on a very young, inoffensive lad and seized the chance of nicking his rifle. The sergeant major was furious, but there was no escaping the consequences of the CO's edict, which was a spell of army prison amongst the hardened criminals. The young lad didn't make a fuss about it at all, took his punishment quietly, but the NCO was a pariah from then on. This was just an example of how the tensions in Palestine got to you. Shortly after I returned home, there was a particular despicable atrocity. Some Israeli terrorists captured two Brits and hanged them in an orange grove. Not content with this, they mined the approaches to kill and maim the soldiers coming to cut the bodies down. This sparked off a nationwide anti-Jewish revulsion. Mr. Cohen, a prominent radio dealer in my local hometown, had his shop windows smashed. Poor mother burst into tears at the news. That could have been her boy dangling at the end of an Israeli rope. But as always in Britain, the outrage died down quickly, except for the unfortunate relatives of the two victims. Nothing deterred the Israelis, certainly not a bad press, who pursued their ruthless realpolitik, and of course with our noble eye America backing them all the way, their ruthlessness paid off with ex-terrorists becoming prime ministers. So, whenever I hear some fatuous, complacent politician declaim about the state of Israel's right to exist, I spit blood. The Israelis have behaved like violent squatters who, after ejecting the rightful occupants, complain about the hostility of the neighbours who don't sympathise with their wish to coexist peacefully with them. Having become lords and masters of Israel, the Israelis should have behaved with decency and generosity towards the Palestinian Arabs and saying, well, look, we'll at least give you this territory in which to live, you know, on the West Bank. But far from doing that, they've just tried to sow the West Bank, the Arab territory, with plantations, you know, of Jewish settlers. So more and more Jewish settlers are coming into what should be Arab territory, and that has acerbated the trouble. And the Palestinians, as a result, have become desperate. And their attitude, basically, is the Israelis behave with ruthlessness and violence. That's the only language they understand, is violent ruthlessness, so we'll give them a bit of their own medicine back. Unfortunately, they're now divided amongst themselves between the moderates and the violent people, and the violent people look as though they're going to win. So there's going to be more and more trouble there, because the Israelis are not going to give any more concessions. They think that they've shown concessions enough, when in fact, in my humble opinion, they haven't made enough concessions. So I think the future prospects are pretty awful, and I can't see any satisfactory ending at all to the situation.
Well, last night, June 14th, the Hamas proclaimed that the era of Islamic rule had arrived in Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this always happens, isn't it? The hard men really take over and become masters with their uncompromising demands. And as their demand is that the Israeli state should be extinguished altogether, the Israelis are obviously not going to buy that, are they? And they're going to be just as ruthless as they are. And there's going to be tit for tat on an ever increasing scale. As I say, if the Israelis at one time had behaved with moderation and generosity and said, right, there you are, you can live on those in this territory, we shan't bother you, and we can coexist peacefully, I think there might be a chance of a settlement. But as I say, in these situations, the hard men always take over and provoke violence. And I'm very pessimistic as to the outlook of it. It's going to be one continuing saga of violence and counter-violence. Because of the increasing hardness and fanaticism of the extreme Palestinians, of course, the West are saying, sorry, we're not going to give resources to you, help and aid to you, and it's the ordinary Palestinian people that are suffering. And they're having a wretched life of it.
So you were actually based in Gaza, weren't you?
Yes. Which was quiet then. Quiet then, yes. So the Israelis are going to suffer because of their own intransigence and ruthlessness initially. They're going to suffer as well.
So you left in 47?
Yes, July 47, yes. And in 1948... The war started properly between the Arabs and the Israelis, and it was no contest really. The Israelis had the sophisticated weapons and all the money and help they needed from the United States. The poor Palestinian Arabs had nobody to help them. So, as I say, it was no contest.
How did you all feel leaving at that stage?
Very relieved. We were more concerned, I think, with our own with our own problems. It was only subsequently that I've sort of felt more sympathy with the Palestinians, because as far as we're concerned, the war was over. We were anxious to get back home. This is a foreign country, problems of which we only faintly understood, and we weren't terribly interested. Let's get home as quick as possible. That was our attitude. It was only later that we were able to take a more detached view of the situation. As far as we're concerned, we were in the middle of the conflict, which was really which we felt was none of our concern.
And then over the years, there were further battles erupted.
And the trouble is, of course, once the Palestinians reacted with violence, Israelis felt that violence was the only way. So you get the tit for tat, and each side saying that the other side is to blame. There are now two factions, the moderates and the extremists, and it's usually the extremists that win in the end, isn't it? So the Israelis must be laughing up their socks, because the enemy, instead of concentrating its fire on them, is fighting each other, which is daft, isn't it? But the situation has got so much out of control now that a reasoned approach by any of the parties, I don't think, is possible.
So when you returned in 1947, I'm sure your mother must have been very relieved.
She was, yes. She spotted me, and to my embarrassment, she was talking to some neighbours, and she said, oh, there's up Fred. She took me in and embarrassed me, and I thought, crikey. But there you are. That's, as a mother yourself, you can understand
her
feelings, yes.
So So how was life for you after the war?
Well, from about 1947 to 1950, things were very drab. Everything was in short supply. As a nation, we were broke. We'd had to borrow heavily from the Americans, and we've only just repaid their debt. Furniture and clothes were rationed and of very poor qualities. Food were rationed, of course, and things like sweets. Fuel at that time was coal. We had coal fires. And Britain, in 46-47, had had one of its very worst winters to capital. Well, I miss that, of course, being out in the Middle East. So I got a job as a temporary civil servant, and I sat an exam, passed it, and became a tax official. And I spent my career as in the Inland Revenue from 1948 to 1986, when I retired at the age of 61 with a pension. And then I thought, well, I know so much about taxation, I'll work for the other side, you see. So I set up my own business, helping taxpayers and working in accountant's office. And for 3.5 years, I was very well paid indeed. So I saved up all that money, got now a nice little bit of capital, so we can live comfortably in our old age. Although we haven't got a big income, we've got our house is paid off, the mortgage is paid off, and we have got some capital. We're quite content with our quiet life.
When did you come to live in Surrey?
In Surrey? 1951, when we got married, we lived in a little maisonette in Greenford, Middlesex. Then when the second boy was born, this became inadequate, so we moved over to Surrey, bought a house there, lived there for 12 years. Then in 1970, a friend of ours at the local church, he was retiring and he wanted to sell his house. I said, right, well, we'll buy a house for you. And we've been there ever since in Cannondale Lane. And it's a very nice quiet spot, lovely neighbourhood, easily accessible shop-wise and everywhere. Got a lot of friends, so there we are, and we're going to stay there until we find that we can't cope with life there. But we're both in reasonably good, both enjoyed reasonably good health, so there we are.
Have you kept in contact with any of the men that you served with?
No, I haven't. Funnily enough, immediately after the war, you're continually meeting ex-soldiers by accident, and occasionally seeing them in the streets, but they pass you by, not recognising you. But after a while, of course, that died away, and if there are any ex-comrades in the streets, we wouldn't recognise them, they wouldn't recognise us. But there it was. No, frankly, World War II was an experience I was very glad to forget about.
I was just going to ask you what feelings you are left with following your experiences during the war.
About what? About
just in general, you know, is there anything that stands out?
What is depressing and sad is the declining of our own country. Good manners and everything else, integrity, people grabbing money, especially people at the top, the fat cats and the banks and the politicians. It's a free-for-all scramble, it's not very edifying. And I really pity out the children that are being reared today, not being taught manners, many of them, by. And the stability of family life. Without that, I don't think there's much help for a civilised life. We know in our own experience, don't we, our own happy family lives and the beneficial effect it's had on our children when they become adults. I'm just glad, I'm sure you are, that are true boys have established good family life. You know.
So, yes, that must be satisfying.
Yes. As I say, the my elder boy, as I say, has got twin children. They're 26. The girl, she's shacking out with a fella. She thinks she wants to marry him. She wants to settle down and have children, married and children, but she's taking him on probation, sort of. She wants to see whether... He's a very nice lad, and I hope they make it. And, as I say, her younger brother, twin brother, he'd actually committed himself to marriage. The girl seemed very happy, content with him, and suddenly she's... because I don't love you anymore. So we rather suspect that she's met somebody else. She's changed the job. But it's been very shattering for him. And he's only just about getting over it. So one of these hard knocks of life that we all experience.
Your whole family is affected.
Yes, it has. Yeah. And it's caused a lot of annoyance and inconvenience, you see, because Dad, their father, had for both children, he'd given them a deposit for a house, but as a precaution, he's got it in black and white. If anything goes wrong with the relationship, he's having that back. So that they've put the Ben and the other boy, he's put his house, his flat up for sale, and he'll be able to start again and so forth. For the moment, he's living with Mum and Dad. He enjoys his life, but as I say, he's only just getting over this bit of a shock. To be rejected isn't very nice, is it?
Not nice at all.
No, at all.
Thank you for sharing your experiences with me.
Thank you for listening to me.